Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to compose a symphony, and what sort of ideas can such a work explore that cannot be covered in an opera? Composer Jake Hege has had remarkable success with operas, including Dead Man Walking and Three Decembers. His opera Moby Dick premiered in Dallas to great national critical acclaim a few years ago. But even before the piece was complete, Hege realized he wasn't finished exploring the meaning and motivations of the obsessive Captain Ahab. So that is where he focused his attention when he was offered a commission by the Artist-in-Residence program at the University of North Texas. The Ahab Symphony premieres tomorrow night at the university's Murchison Performing Arts Center and will feature tenor soloist Richard Croft along with the UNT Symphony Orchestra and Grand Chorus. Jake, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So have you actually sat in yet on a rehearsal and heard this whole thing played start to finish?
I've heard it in the different sections because it's, there's a large orchestra, there's a 250-voice chorus, and there's a soloist. And so it's been piece by piece, putting all of those together. So when I was here last week, I heard just the orchestra by itself. And then the next night I heard just the choir. And then we added the soloist in. And then last night was the first time we heard everybody together in the actual space, which was thrilling and terrifying all at the same time.
Terrifying why? I mean, clearly you can visualize, and that's not really the right word, but I don't know what the oral version of that is. You know what it's going to sound like.
Well, I have a good idea. I figure, people are very visual, so I try to give a visual reference. A painter, a sculptor, you can see their process, what they're working as they're working it out. I'm sort of working with oral clay, shaping sounds in a sound world, and then trying to get the idea of what that sounds like onto the page clear enough so that someone who isn't in my head can read what was in my head and make it come to life. So I'm entirely dependent on the performer to realize my vision. So the terrifying part is, of course, did I get it accurately on the page? What did I get wrong? And in a score as large as an opera or a symphony, you're dealing with thousands and thousands and thousands of notes and little details. And it's easy to miss something or get it wrong, or a typo gets learned and then you have to undo it. But luckily, this was in very, very good shape. And so the terror of listening to it for the first time actually turned into actual thrilling joy because it sounds fantastic and everyone has worked so hard and it's come together in this magnificent way. And I just find that terribly, terribly inspiring when a vibration that was set in motion, say by an author or an event or an action, somehow inspires me and vibrates within my head and heart. And I work really hard to get that on the page, and then that vibration manages to translate into all these other performers. So to have, over 300 people, in the same vibration, and David Itkin, the conductor, leading, and all of them in that pulse and that beat, and all of us going on that journey with them, I just find that terribly inspiring and thrilling, and something that can only really happen in a concert hall live to get the full effect of that.
Does the presence of the audience, even though they're trying to be very, very, very quiet, also affect the sound of things?
Absolutely. It affects not only the sound, but the whole feeling of what you're doing. I'm a performer too, and you can tell whether an audience is with you or not. And when they're not, it becomes real work.
Yeah.
And when they're with you, when they really open up and go along with you and get absorbed into the momentum and the timing and the pacing of the world that you've opened up for them orally, it's a really thrilling thing because you feel like you're all going on a journey together. Again, it just feels like there is this single vibration that everyone is going with, which is really exciting because music is all about vibration. And, feelings and emotions are vibrations and also electrical impulses in us. So, and chemical reactions and things. So if the vibration is right, somehow we all just lock into that. And I just find that terribly interesting and inspiring and thrilling, especially because the energy that the students at UNT are bringing to this is very special. Young people are so energized and passionate about something. They, you know, you can get into the professional world and you hope that everyone's going to be energized and passionate. But, you know, sometimes people are in a routine. This is their work. This is their job. And it can be special, but it loses a little bit of that youthful enthusiasm and energy. And that's what I love about what's going on in the rehearsal process. And I know we'll continue through the performance tomorrow to have all of those young students so gifted and so committed and so passionate, really all focused on the same result. You know, I one of the things that I love about being in this business is, to me, it is entirely positive. It is entirely good. And we were talking about this just before we went on the air, every new commission is a real vote for the future. And it's about believing in the future, about us together putting all our differences aside and just working for a single beautiful result that moves and inspires us. I mean, that is tremendous that in this day and age, people feel compelled and motivated to make that happen. And that's what's happening tomorrow night at UNT.
Is it typical for a living composer to work closely with a conductor before a premiere?
It's much more typical than the dead composer.
Well, right. What I wanted to say is I recognize it's not always a possibility even.
But. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. Especially because, like I said, you know, I have this idea of how it sounds in my head, and I have to convey that. And the conductor, more than anyone, has to be sort of the living embodiment of what was in the composer's head. And in that moment of performance, making that, realizing that vision, and transferring that to the choir, to the orchestra, to the soloist. And Richard Croft is just one of the greatest tenors in the world. He's a great, great artist, not just a beautiful singer, but a real artist. And so to work with him as well in this process is tremendous. But yeah, to work closely with the soloist, everything right at the beginning is very, very important. And then trusting it to them. This is the other terrifying part, is to trust them to go with that and then invest themselves in it and find out how it resonates for them. What is their opinion? What life experience do they bring to it? Because I have a vision of it in my head or visually if it's a stage work. But then what makes it richer is that they bring their life experience and their vision to it, and they might make it much, much bigger and better than I could ever have imagined on my own.
So find something in it that you hadn't initially seen yourself.
Exactly. Because I don't think creative artists necessarily know everything they're writing about. Mm-hmm. You know, people will always say to me, so what's this piece about? And I can sort of guess here and there what I think I'm writing about. But the fact is, I'm just writing and I'm just listening and awake to something that inspired my imagination and that I had an emotional response to, and that I want to spend a year, 2 years, 3 years of my life focusing on and getting onto the page. But I don't necessarily know everything that's in there. I don't think you can. And so when you bring fresh perspective and fresh eyes and ears, they'll read something else into it that I didn't know was there, you know. And then suddenly when they mention it, it'll seem obvious to me maybe, but mm-hmm. You know.
That's a really interesting point, because I think novelists sort of labor under the same problem. You know, everyone performs exegesis on what they've written, and mm-hmm. it may or may not reflect a conscious thought, and it says more about what the reader experienced than maybe what the writer.
Absolutely,
had to say.
And I think that's in composition. That's the test of a piece that will really last, is that you sense the profile and the vision of the composer, no matter what performance you hear. And yet performances can be so individual and personal that you do get different information each time, and it merits different interpretations and performances. And I think those pieces are the ones that tend to endure, where there is a central, solid message that we get what the piece is about, but there's a lot more information than just one performance can give to us.
Have you ever heard your work performed by an orchestra or an opera company that was just awful?
Well, yes, and I will not name any names.
No, please don't, but I'm curious about what that feels like.
It is, that's when the terrifying thing
happens. Yeah.
And, I'm so grateful when a company wants to take on the challenge, or a soloist or whoever, and I can always tell when there's great heart into it. And especially if they're embracing something new, there is great heart. But then sometimes it just goes wrong. And, you know, all I can do is just sort of sit there and be grateful for the opportunity to work with them, but also hoping that maybe I can bring some insight that maybe will make it better for the next composer that comes along. Or I just try to give it perspective. You know, there are times when I have wanted to hide under a rock or just run fleeing, you know, hands waving, blonde curls flying and screaming into the hills. But, you know, I have to remember that once I put the piece onto the page and after the initial performance where I'm involved, it really does not belong to me anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's true with a novelist's work or, you know, a poet's work. A choreographer, you know, anyone like that, it doesn't belong to you anymore. And so you have to trust it to people to respect it and love it and care for it. It's like sending a child out into the world in a way.
And what a strange thing to unlock, though, this thing that you have mm-hmm. controlled every down to the last beat, yeah. every note, every measure. And then suddenly to say, goodbye, good luck.
I'll tell you a great story on that. When Jean Shear and I were writing Moby Dick, mm-hmm. for the Dallas Opera, we had been working for 2 solid years, and the piece really belonged to us. And then it was time to start rehearsals. And while we were in the car driving to the first rehearsal, Jean, we had what we called the car of truth, where we could say anything every day.
You're not looking at each other right? in the eye. You
just, right. Yeah. We could just say what we feel. And Jean said to me, Jake, I love our opera. I think we did a really good job. I know it's a really good piece. I wish we didn't have to do it with people. I hate them. I hate them all. They're going to have opinions, you know, mm-hmm. and it turned out to be a wonderful experience. Yeah. But that initial idea of letting it go mm-hmm. is very, very hard. And it is like a parent trusting a child to be okay on their own, sitting it off for the first time and then hoping the world treats your child well and that your child is strong enough to stand on its own. And because you do it with what I do, I put years of my life into a piece and a lot of trust and faith and belief. And that's why working closely with the people who are going to first perform it or who I'm collaborating with, that makes a huge difference. And they've been very generous with that at UNT with this symphony. I just one of the great things about working with a university too versus a professional organization is we've had an enormous amount of rehearsal time. And rehearsal time is at a premium in a professional organization.
It's expensive.
Very expensive, very limited. Of course, you're dealing with professionals, so you can get a lot of work done very quickly. But all of these students have handled themselves so professionally, and the conductor is so wonderful, and Rick Croft is a great soloist. So no one's wasting any time. And the dean of the College of Music, James Scott, has sort of been the godfather, the guardian of this piece all the way through. And he's really shepherded it along and made sure we have exactly what we need every step of the way so that it has felt like a professional process, but we've had a great deal of rehearsal time to really, really work, which has been wonderful.
We're speaking this hour with composer Jake Hege. He's in town for the premiere of his Ahab Symphony. It'll be performed by the UNT Symphony Orchestra at the university's Murchison Performing Arts Center, Murchison Performing Arts Center. The performance will also be streamed live at untmusiclive.com. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
explain it's not his fault how he treated you today. His brother got the heavens while he was stuck in the hell. To justify his cruelty, that's the story he will tell and tell.
That is Patti LuPone singing Anne's Lament from Jake Hagee's To Hell and Back. Jake Hagee is here. The composer is in town for the premiere of his Ahab Symphony, which will be performed by the UNT Symphony Orchestra at the Murchison, I'll get that right one of these days, Murchison Performing Arts Center, my apologies, tomorrow. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jake, were you, like, the first time you picked up Moby Dick when you were 14, were you the greatest fan ever and just decided that you would spend years of your life exploring this piece of work?
Oh, absolutely not. First of all, I did not pick it up at 14. I knew about it at 14, the way it's sort of ubiquitous in our society.
Yeah.
Which was why I think it was such a really good idea for an opera, is that everyone has a familiarity with it. But most people, I mean, it really is the great American novel that most people have not read, you know? And so the fact that familiarity is really great for a new opera. But the fact that a lot of people don't know the nitty-gritty details of the story means it's wide open for exploration from a creative team. And the idea first happened in 2010, and it came from my friend Terrence McNally. And then I wound up writing the opera with Gene Shear, who wrote a brilliant libretto. And our biggest fear at that time was that the Melville Society, the diehard Melville fans, would just be up in arms, because we really did take a lot of liberties in the telling of the story on the stage, mm-hmm. which you have to do. It doesn't make any sense to try to put a novel on the stage. But they were there, they remain our greatest supporters. And it's been an amazing experience to work with them and get to know those brilliant people. But what they liked is that we took the spirit of Herman Melville's masterpiece and tried to find a core linear story that we could tell in 3 hours on the stage with music. They liked it so much that one of the Melville Society members, Robert Wallace, has done a book about the making of the opera, and that book is coming out actually tomorrow is the official release date. And it features like a couple hundred photos by Karen Almond, who was there through the whole creative process of it. But I really only picked up the book and read it through 2 times when the idea first happened. So what is this? 2013? No, it was 2005 when the idea happened. So 8 years ago. The 2010 was the premiere. But I did become obsessed with it, and I understand why people spend their lives studying it, because it is so dense and so rich and so beautiful and powerful and funny and human and surreal all at the same time. There are great depths not only to the writing, but it makes you want to explore the great depths that are below us, above us, and within the person next to us. And it's a lot about what's unknowable. And it's also a lot about how the world is a very random place, and random things do happen, and we look for meaning in those things, and we can rail against the randomness of things. But ultimately, there's not much we can do. And I think it was that thought that led me to want to explore even further the character of Ahab in this symphony that's premiering tomorrow. Melville gives Ahab the most poetic, beautiful, deep language of any character in the book. And yet he is a fierce-looking person. He's scarred and wounded. And the brilliance of that, to me, in Melville's from Melville's imagination, is that we all carry big scars. It's just most of them are inside. Hmm. You don't see them. Ahab wears his scars outside. We see what a wounded, you know, torn man he is. And yet he has a poet's heart and soul. So I think that's a really interesting thing to explore, especially in this day and age where it's easy for us to create monsters out of people who are people. We're all just people, and random things happen, and people make poor choices, or people have events in their lives that influence them to make poor choices or to choose something evil over something good. But we all have that capability within us, and that's something I really wanted to meditate on further in this symphonic work.
So, what can you do in a symphony that wasn't available to you maybe creatively when you were working on the opera?
Well, operas have to have action. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, the music stems from conflict or desire or something that you want, and something's in the way of what you want.
So you're moving in a linear fashion.
Yeah, and it's theater. So, I mean, it comes from action. It has to spring from action. And the music is about not only that location and those people, but what they want and how they're in conflict. And that's a really fun thing to explore as a composer, to have a landscape of 2.5 to 3 hours to explore something and develop and listen organically as you know, an event happens and someone reacts in a surprising way. And maybe what they're saying doesn't actually reflect what they're thinking, you know, or feeling. And you can explore that musically too. So all of that in an opera has to come from action. In a symphonic work, you can be very meditative and reflective in a moment. And the moment that I chose in this symphony is the moment right after Ahab has spotted the whale, and he knows this is probably going to be his last day. So in the opera, it would be as if time stopped right there. And I pick up the music from that moment at the very beginning of the symphony and then meditate on that for nearly a half hour. Just what it is in that moment to know you have done, you've found what you were looking for. And yet you look out at the world on this, your last day on the planet, and really think about, has anything changed? Why am I so torn in this moment? So the thing that you can do symphonically is really reflect on that feeling, that moment, and really get deep into that. And it was so much fun to do. It was really, really hard because I am a theater composer, so I like to work from action to stop and really meditate on all of these thoughts that are going through his head was really something. And the turning point for me, because I kept wondering what this symphony was going to be. It went through many different permutations and ideas. And then Gene Shear is actually the one who led me to this poem by W.H. Auden called Herman Melville, which gives us a little picture of Melville the author at the end of his life. And his life ended in a way he did not expect. I mean, the randomness of things you talk about. You know, he put everything into Moby Dick, which was published when he was 32. And then his career was over because it was a colossal flop.
Yeah, he was working in, what, like a patent office or a post office?
He was a customs officer.
Okay. Yeah.
In New York. And he died 40 years after Moby Dick's publication and had really not been read for 3 decades. And Auden's poem is this loving tribute to this man who created these magical worlds that still affect our imaginations to this day. It's a little like Dickinson. You know, Emily Dickinson, you know, stayed very quiet and was not famous or published in her lifetime. And it was afterwards that she was discovered to be the genius that she was and also that she knew she was. And Melville, I think, knew what a powerful gift he had, too. So it must have been killing, you know, to sit there anonymously when you had created this magnificent piece of art.
Do you think Melville, at the end of his life, was wondering what had changed in the same way that Ahab did?
I don't know. But I imagine that it had to have gone through his head because he went through a lot of trauma and drama in his life. He was probably not a very easy person to know or to love, a very moody person. But he had his father died when he was very young and left the family in shatters. And that's when Melville had to make a living outside of what had been a fairly privileged life. And he went into whaling, which was a filthy, awful profession and very dangerous. And then he found a voice as an author. So, and then, you know, he lost his sons, while they were young. So it was a very dramatic, traumatic life for him. So I imagine all the way through, you'd be reflecting on what happened, what went wrong. And here's the character of Ahab. So I juxtaposed that Auden text, Herman Melville, with one of Ahab's last monologues, and it's only a few lines from the last chapter of Moby Dick, but it's Ahab at the end of his life with what he knows to be his last day, looking out at the world on a beautiful, beautiful day where he says, you know, it looks exactly the same as it did when I was a boy. And then he thinks it's the same as it was to Noah. You know, it's never changed. And what has my life and all this, you know, turmoil and violence and struggle, what has this mattered in the big scheme of things? And I thought that's a really interesting thing to meditate on. And like I said, I don't really know all that's in this symphony, but I know that those are the things that inspired me to want to write.
And your soloist, Richard Croft, is singing as Ahab. Is that correct?
He's a tenor soloist who sings Ahab's words, but I don't necessarily think of him as Ahab because to me it's not an active role.
Right.
Okay. He's the tenor soloist and his words are all Ahab's, and the choir sings the Auden poem and the choir joins him at one point where I feel like the two worlds meld very, very clearly in a very stormy moment. And I did pull music from the opera, so people who know the opera will hear familiar music from it. And that opera has had a very good life so far. It's been all around the world, and it will be on great performances this fall. And then a DVD and a recording. So there are tunes from the opera and music from the opera, but there's also a lot of original material that I discovered because I think of stopping and really meditating on this poem and also thinking about the forces that I was writing for these great kids in the choir. I call them kids. They're young adults, right? Young professionals in the choir and in the orchestra and for Rick.
So when you write for the voice of a specific vocalist,
always.
But you must know that you know, if things go as you hope they will, that this will be performed by multiple other individuals whose gifts are different, whose sort of vocal sound is different. Was that ever a question for you as to whether you ought to sort of do something that's less specific to one person's voice?
What I do when I write is, first of all, I have to know who I'm writing for. I'm writing for the role or the character, but knowing who I'm dressing it on makes all the difference in the world, because it's about personality and emotional world. And if I know that person and what they can bring to the stage, it actually inspires, it makes the palette even bigger, you know, because it becomes very clear. It's like I could write a violin concerto or something like that, but it would be a meaningless piece unless I really know the personality of that violinist to me, because they're going to bring something to it that someone else won't, and that will be my human connection to it. So I have to know who I'm writing for. And what I find is if I write the role really well for the character, even though I'm dressing it on that original person, if I write the role really well, suddenly a lot of people show up who are exactly right for
it. It'll translate.
It translates. And that's been my experience. Whereas if I'm only writing a piece to cater specifically to an individual, if I'm not writing for the role or the character, but I'm really writing something that is biographical for that singer or that performer, then it's very limited. But if I really think broadly of the character and the role, it will work beautifully for that first person. And then because it works beautifully for that first person, it opens up a door for many other singers of that type who will bring something else to it that will be very interesting.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Mike in Las Colinas. Hi, Mike.
Yes. Hello, Chris. Great show as always. You kind of stole my thunder there because you kind of went into that question that I really wanted to ask the composer about how open he was to input from a particular soloist when he has a work kind of going through that evolutionary process as a composer. And there's one story I do know about when Brahms was writing his violin concerto that he worked very closely with the soloist during that time in Vienna when they were both there creating that work. But I would like to hear just a little bit of how much he is open to the input from, you know, world-renowned soloists when he creates these works. So I'll just take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Mike. Very good question. I work very closely with everyone involved with it. They're, to me, they are collaborators, too. I love the collaborative process. Again, I have a certain perspective, and what gifted people who are on the same page with me will bring is fresh perspective, and suddenly that might inspire another wonderful idea. When I was writing the opera Dead Man Walking, I was not only working closely with wonderful Susan Graham, who is currently in Dallas singing at the Aspern Papers at the Dallas Opera, and who's a very good friend. I was not only working with her and Terrence McNally and the conductor Patrick Summers, but I was also working with the actual sister Helen Prejean. And her personality helped me a great deal. She was a great friend to the project, never sort of interfered. But always was supportive and interested, and just conversations with her gave me so much information. And knowing wonderful Susie Graham's personality really helped me understand that this is how to write the role to make that a fully formed person. So, and then in rehearsals, workshop first and then in rehearsals, always listening to the singer to make sure that the vowels are comfortable for the notes that I'm asking for, that the rhythm of it, that they have enough time to get the words out, that they feel that my intuition for it can be expressed well as it's written. And if they have an idea of how, like, they might need more time or they might need less time, I'm wide open to that because we all have a similar goal. We want the piece to work. And that's why I'm always surrounding myself with collaborators who have very friendly, kind ears. Not nice ears. You know, I don't want people just to compliment and tell me what's going on. I want them to tell me the truth in a kind way. And that's what great collaborators will do.
Composer Jake Hagee is my guest. He's in town for the premiere of his Ahab Symphony. It'll be performed by the UNT Symphony Orchestra at the Murchison Performing Arts Center tomorrow. It will also be streamed live at untmusiclive.com. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
That is Susan Graham singing This Journey from Jake Hagee's opera Dead Man Walking. Jake Hagee is in town for the premiere of his Ahab Symphony, which will be performed by the UNT Symphony Orchestra at the Murchison Performing Arts Center tomorrow and streamed live at untmusiclive.com. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Jake, when you talk about collaborating, I think a lot of people probably imagine you in a beautiful soundproof room at a gorgeous piano, but laboring sort of entirely in solitude.
Well, that is actually a lot of it. Mm-hmm. You know, the creative part of it is. But that's why I love collaborating, is because it makes it a little less lonely, that journey. And it really does inspire me. And we were talking about collaborators early in the question that Mike raised. And one, the first excerpt you played of mine was with Patti LuPone, who is a Broadway singer. Mm-hmm. And that piece, To Hell and Back, was with a Baroque orchestra. They had asked me and Gene Shear, my wonderful collaborator Gene Shear, to write a piece, a modern piece, on an old myth. And so Gene had this wonderful take on the rape of Persephone, which we called To Hell and Back, which was about a woman trapped in an abusive marriage. And the woman who saves her is not her mother, it's her mother-in-law. And Patti LuPone played that role. Now, not only had I never written for a Baroque orchestra, so I was entirely dependent on the conductor to guide me through that process, but I'd never written for a Broadway belter before, which is a very different kind of voice type.
Yeah.
And so, again, I was writing a role, but I was dressing it on Patti LuPone, her personality, her big personality, her wonderful voice, her very specific sort of way of singing and conveying something. And so wrote that for her, which was a huge challenge, and worked with her on it every step of the way to make sure it was comfortable for her while keeping it right for the character. And then there's the process of this journey, which Susan Graham sang, working very closely with her to make sure that the whole role, which is an immense role, the role of Sister Helen in Dead Man Walking, make sure that was comfortable for her, but also right for the character. Like, there were places where she actually asked me a few times, do you mind if I, like, take this down a little bit? And I'm like, you know what, dramatically, it's just not going to have the same impact. But let's look at another place where we can give you a little break.
You make it sound like there are no egos involved in this process. And is that really the case?
Well, what I find when you work with really, really gifted people who are confident about what they do, and we're all working to create something together, that you do put ego aside. Mm-hmm. And because, again, you're focused on the result. You're focused on, especially in creating a new opera, you're focused on telling the story the best way we possibly can. In a symphony, we're looking at everyone working together to get this thought, this big thought that takes 30 minutes to get through. How do we best do that together? You know, so I can't control every single part of it, because I have to hand it over as a composer to the performers. So I want them to work with me the same way I think they want me to work with them, to make this something where they feel they can approach it with confidence and real emotional connection. So of course there's ego involved in everything, but we set aside any negative connotation of ego, and we put only the positive part of it in there, so that everyone is bringing their best game and the best information possible to the table. You know, any business that you work in, it's about the people you work with.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, right? And one person who's not in the loop can bring the whole thing down.
Right. I can feel that way anyway.
It can be miserable. And with something, a creative journey like this, you're really a bunch of people are moving into a house together. So you have to be very careful who your roommates are in this house, because if one of them decides they want this kind of decor and is, you know, or is completely against, you know, juxtaposed against someone else in the house, it's going to be miserable and it can make the whole thing fall apart. So working with great professionals who, of course, have egos, we all do, you know, and are very proud of the work that they do, but we approach each other with great respect. And again, we're all focused on achieving the same goal. And that's really inspiring, because it brings out the best in everybody. And that's what I have found with the projects I've been lucky enough to work on, is you get a great director and conductor and collaborator, writing collaborator, and great cast. And then when you are all on the same page working together, it really does bring out the best, because everyone believes in it and they want to bring something special to it. You know, part of the question, too, about collaborators, if you look historically, Mozart knew who he was writing for. So did Verdi, Brahms, Puccini, Handel, Bach. They knew who they were writing for. And that, again, is a different kind of inspiration, because so much of the creative part of writing is by yourself. So sitting in my airless soundproof studio in front of a beautiful piano, mm-hmm. which I do have, and just sitting there and listening to the voices inside, you know, and trying to stay out of their way so that they speak and I can just take down the dictation, so that it's very organic and free. And then sharing that with people. In Moby Dick, I worked with Ben Heppner and Morgan Smith and Stephen Costello to let them know what I was writing, so that they would feel confident that I was respecting not only their personality and their voice, but what they would bring to the stage, challenging them and giving them something that they could approach with confidence. It's a great process. I love it.
Forgive my ignorance here, Jake. When you are composing, are you literally writing on a piece of paper, or is this all done digitally now? And how does that work just to physically take down the ideas that you've had?
Well, I'm an old guy.
We're about the same age, so you're not that old.
I still write everything by hand, and then I send everything to a copyist. The most important part, though, is before I start writing, because a teacher of mine back when I was at school at UCLA, one of the most important things he said is, like, you're a pianist, so it's natural for you to go to the keyboard to want to work things out. He said, that's fine. Just make sure you get your ideas away from the piano. So because if you only get your ideas at the piano, you'll be limited to what your fingers can do. Because the minute you hit a note, everything changes. Suddenly there's sound in the air. And
it exists.
It exists in a different way, whereas it's completely abstract in your head. So to get the idea away from the piano and really take the time to think it through before I play the first note on the piano to sort of start working it out.
That's fascinating.
And then I will find things randomly on the keyboard sometimes, but mostly I try to get the idea before I even set it down. And then it's the labor of writing it down and a part that I love that is so frustrating and so wonderful, which is making a huge mess, like crossing things out, crumpling up paper, tearing it up. When I was writing Moby Dick, I at one point threw away 60 huge pages of music that I had written.
Do you literally like put your head down on the keyboard like in, you know, in comedy shows or whatever? Like, this is not going to work.
Oh, one of Gene Shear's great quotes is from Ernest Hemingway, where he says, writing is very easy. I just sit in front of the typewriter until blood gushes out of my forehead. So there is a little of that feeling every now and then where I had writer's block, a really bad one, when writing this symphony, and it arrived very late. It was from a combination of things, which I can identify now, but which at the time were a mystery to me. But it was literally like, I feel like we need to have someone come in and repair the drywall in our house from where I've beat my head against the wall. You know, it can be very terrifying and frustrating, and writer's block is a very real thing. And I think we go through that creatively as creative artists, but I think people go through that in their daily lives when you hit a block in your life and you're just not sure how to get through that brick wall and you can't see the path around the brick wall, you know.
Well, it's interesting to me because it seems that anyone walking around that has, you know, a thought, an idea, can express it in words. Some people are particularly good at expressing their ideas in writing.
Yeah.
It seems to me that artists of all kind, but composers in particular, have this sort of third kind of wisdom. It's like a totally different ability to express a thought in music. I can't even imagine how that would feel. And I wonder for you in your own life, how you decide, I have a big idea, how you decide this one must be expressed in music and this one I can write about or I can talk about or I can just think about it.
Well, I respond to almost everything in musical terms. And I think that started when I was really little. I always responded to storytelling through music. And my favorite singer, I didn't know anything about opera or classical music when I was really little. Julie Andrews was the first person that made that real for me. I saw The Sound of Music when I was like 5 or 6 years old and just like, I couldn't believe it. There was this person singing. I understood every word. The emotion was so clear and it enhanced the storytelling and it let me know more about her as a person. And those, so I always sort of focused on solo artists and that always seemed a very natural way to work things out for me. When my father died when I was 10, it was a suicide and it sort of blew my family apart. And luckily I had music at that time. And so I just buried myself in music and I found such a home in music. And then I found my people, which were other musicians. And so for us to get together as individuals and work through these pieces, whether they were original or old masters' works, you know, together, that was just like food for my soul. So it didn't feel strange. It felt very, very natural to me. And that's always sort of the direction that my mind and heart takes me, is to express something that way. And I've been in that, you know, that pool of water for so long, that river of music. And I feel, that's why I feel, I think, so compelled to talk to students. And I do these little residencies at universities all over. I did one at UNT a couple of years ago. And I've been at Cornell and Vanderbilt and UCLA and USC and all different kinds of universities. I just feel really compelled to share things that I've learned along the way what that experience is of total immersion in music, what it is to be a citizen of the world and yet feel so imbued with music that you can't wait to write it down or get it out, and what it is to find your people, you know, whatever field that it is.
Yeah.
I mean, what an amazing thing that is. And also to tell them as individuals that not to forget to live your life, to live a really full life. Go to museums, go to the movies, go on walks, get outside, you know, be a person, nurture the relationships you have. All of that is going to feed the music that's inside of you, and it's going to make your life better. You know, I mean, that's a very long, broad answer to the question that you ask, but I think it all goes back to something that feels very natural for me. And yet I realize how lucky I am to live in that world. It's really kind of a magical thing. And to get into that sort of creative, concentrated zone that we all yearn for, where time stops. And
the Chicks and Mihaly state of flow. Yeah.
Where suddenly 6 hours go by and you have no idea because it's been so engaging and productive. I mean, that's like a drug.
Do you write at the same time every day?
Mm-mm. I don't. I have all these projects lined up because I have to be working on a current one, developing something down the line, and then also thinking about what's going to be beyond that. Because I'm an independent artist. You were talking about, you know, saving and 401ks
gotta make a living,
and things,
right.
You know. You have to treat it as a profession, mm-hmm. and I'm my own boss. I don't have an association with a university or an organization, so I have to treat this very respectfully. But there are many different things that I have to do well in order to make this profession work. I can't just sit there and write music. I have to, again, be developing things, working on professional relationships and contacts. I love working with kids. I think that's very important, and it's overlooked by a lot of professionals, and so I try to encourage other professionals to do the same thing. I have a family. I have a wonderful partner, and we have a 17-year-old son who's going to be going to college soon.
So you want to spend that last time
together. I have to try to be close. And so I try to be very diligent about maintaining a professional schedule that gets the work done but doesn't interfere with the family time and the personal time. It's very, very tricky, very difficult, because my profession requires a lot of travel. It requires a lot of engagement and interaction. But I don't write the same time every day, but I do work on things every day. Because even if I'm not in my studio, I am working on music. Even while we're talking now, I'm sure something is happening in my imagination for the project that I'm working on next.
That's cool.
Which is exciting. And, you know, again, I feel like I'm one of the luckiest people I know for being able to make a life in music. What could be richer?
Composer Jake Heggie is in town for the premiere of his Ahab Symphony. It will take place tomorrow night at UNT's Murchison Performing Arts Center. Jake, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great thrill to be here, and I'll see people tomorrow night or online streaming.
That's right.
Exactly.
Okay. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.